Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Charger Online podcast. My name is Stella Brewer-Vartanian, and today, my good friend Peyton Holsworth will be joining me. Peyton, would you like to introduce yourself a bit?
Hi, I'm Stella's good friend Peyton Holsworth, and I'm very excited to be here.
All right, well, I'm happy to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
So, today Peyton and I are here to talk about a theory that I've composed about a certain man and some crimes he may have committed.
Oh, ominous.
I am, as you can tell by the title, going to talk about Jeffrey Lynn Hand, an Indiana-born delivery man and convicted murderer and kidnapper. I'm here today to present my theory about how Hand might have killed upwards of 6 people. Now, before we begin, it's important for me to note a few things. First of all, most of what I'm proposing today is a theory, and I will make sure to clarify when something is fact and when something is speculation. Second of all, I'd like to clarify that neither Peyton nor I are qualified detectives or researchers into criminal psychology or forensics. All we are sharing today is based on circumstantial evidence. With those things out of the way, let's get started.
Okay.
Alright, so before we get into the crimes, both confirmed and theorized, we need to start with a description of Jeffrey Lynn Hand, the man in question. So Hand was born in Washington, Indiana, on Wednesday, February 2nd, 1949, to a reportedly abusive home. Sean Keene, the Terre Haute's chief of police, told reporters in a press conference in 2019 that he had talked to relatives of Hand and learned that Hand had grown up in an abusive household. However, the details of abuse were not expanded upon. Trauma in a person's childhood has generally been recognized as a shared trait among serial killers, but that's not to say that childhood trauma causes someone to become a serial killer. As Toronto historian and true crime author Peter Voronsky puts it, many serial killers are survivors of early childhood trauma of some physical or sexual abuse, family dysfunction, emotionally distant or abuse in or absent parents. Trauma is the single reoccurring theme in the biographies of most killers. Hand had sandy-colored hair and was frequently described as having a youthful and boyish appearance, which, as theorized by investigators, might have allowed for Hand to look for victims on college campuses without suspicion. Hand attended Washington High School in Daviess County and, in his school yearbook during his senior year, appeared to be a clean-cut and rather normal teenager. Now, this is where my information about Hand becomes a tad murky. So on Hand's Find a Grave page, the only text featured in his memorial is A1C, U.S. Air Force, Vietnam. Hand's page was created by Sergeant Walter Dean Hamlin, a retired sergeant in the Army and the owner of Hamlin Cemetery. This text seems to suggest that Hand might have been an airman first class in the United States Air Force during the Vietnam War, from sometime between 1967 and 1972. Now, I searched the National Archives catalog for any sort of record of Hand being in the military, and I couldn't find any, but my skills with searching through archives are unlimited, so I might have improperly searched for the right records. Due to either my lack of ability or the lack of resources, it's not known when Hand served in Vietnam, what his enlistment was like, and if he was even in the military at all. But unfortunately, war can bring out the worst in violent people, such as Hand, leading already disturbed people to become more unstable after their service. If Hand had served in the military, it is possible that the experience made him more troubled and aggressive than he was already. Whenever Hand returned from the military, if he did at all, he began work as a delivery man for a post office local to Terre Haute. By 1972, however, he would work as a delivery man for an unnamed record company based in Chicago. The job took him across many states in the Midwest. Namely, his routes often took him through Illinois and Indiana. Contrary to popular belief, serial killers are unlikely to travel to commit their crimes. In criminologist Scott Bond's book, Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers, Bond explains that most serial killers have very well-defined geographic areas of operation. They typically have a comfort zone. That is, an area that they are intimately familiar with and where they like to stalk and kill their prey. Bond further explains that in the FBI's 2005 report on serial murder, the crime data reveals that very few serial predators actually travel interstate to kill. The few serial killers who do travel interstate to kill typically fall into one of three categories. Itinerant individuals who periodically move from place to place, 2, chronically homeless individuals who live transiently, or 3, individuals whose jobs, functions, lends themselves to interstate or transnational travel, such as truck drivers or those in the military service. Jeffrey Lynn Hahn is unique in the fact that he, unlike most serial killers, committed his crimes across a wide net of locations thanks to his job allowing him to travel without suspicion. The farthest confirmed location of a crime he committed clocks in about 180 miles away from his home in Warrington, Indiana. So by 1973, Hahn was married with three small sons. Apparently, the abuse of Hahn's childhood carried on to his marriage. The National Institute of Justice published a special report titled Practical Implications of Current Domestic Violence Research for Law Enforcement, Prosecutors, and Judges, and in Section 3.8, the report details the following. It is not surprising that research from the National Youth Survey found that most men, 76%, who engage in domestic violence report also engaging in one or more deviant acts concurrently, including illegal behaviors such as stealing or illicit drug use. Hahn's wife would go on to say that she learned to never question where her husband was during his long travels. The marriage was so dysfunctional that the two were living separately by 1973, with Hahn's wife and children living in Washington, Indiana, and Hahn living on a small farm in Warrington, Indiana. Alright, so now that we've gotten through what admittedly limited details we have about Hahn and what the state of his mind was like, it's time to get into his crimes. Today, we'll be sharing the cases of three unsolved murders and two missing persons cases that we believe Hahn might have been responsible for. We will also be sharing two murders and a kidnapping that Hahn has been officially tied to. All right. Peyton, anything to say?
I'm so excited.
Oh boy. All right. So, our first theorized murder is that of Barbara Ann Hilton in August of 1972. 23-year-old Hilton was described by her loved ones as having a wild side and not being a very stable person. She had a daughter that was raised by her parents, but she never revealed the identity of the father to anyone. What her parents did learn, however, was that Hilton, who was white, had dated interracially, which was still considered very controversial at the time. Hilton worked as a nursing aide at St. Anthony's Hospital at the time of her disappearance while also studying nursing at Lakeland College. Hilton was described as a reliable employee but a poor student. Despite this, she planned to attend nursing school in Edwardsville in the fall once the school semester began. Hilton was rather petite, standing at 5'2 to 5'3 and weighing around 120 pounds. She had long brown hair with blue eyes and also had a 3-inch scar on the right side of her neck. According to her friends, Hilton carried a knife for protection. Now, unfortunately, again, our story muddies here. So there are two narratives to the circumstances of Hilton's disappearance, one from the Doe Network and one from the Charlie Project. I will share both, and specifically, I'll share the Doe Network's version first. So this version says that on Friday, August 4th of 1972, Hilton left her boyfriend's house at 10 p.m. and drove in her sister's green 1968 Chevrolet Nova to a local restaurant called the High Point Tavern. While at the tavern, she was approached by two men and was never seen again. The police found Hilton's car abandoned a few miles away along Illinois 121. The car was not disabled, and it was determined that the car was originally on Centerline Road and moved a few hundred feet north a little after midnight. DoeNetwork.org also says that her remains may have been placed into an old well which has since been filled in. DoeNetwork.org does not elaborate on how or where they got this information, so your guess is as good as mine. But the Charlie Project tells a different story. The Charlie Project states that Hilton left her parents' home at 7 p.m., telling them that she was going to see a movie with her friends. The Charlie Project does not confirm if she truly did go and see a movie with her friends, or if that was like a cover story of some sort. Hilton arrived at her boyfriend's house at 8 p.m., and apparently left at 1 a.m. After she left her boyfriend's house, she was never seen again. Her sister's car, which she was driving in, was found abandoned about 7 miles from her house, parked on the edge of the lane, partially in the road. Hilton's keys were missing, but the car was not disabled. Flies were buzzing around her trunk, but there were no signs of foul play, albeit a recent rainstorm had washed away all fingerprints from the exterior. The Charlie Project states that there may have been a potential sighting of her in the area a week after her car was found, but otherwise Hilton has not been heard from since. So.
Okay, two very different versions there. The only thing in common was the car, you know, and even then there are some different details. And so does the Charlie Project, like, provide where they got that information?
They did not. Actually, they may have at the bottom. And so, personally, I mean, my opinion doesn't really mean much in this, but I think the Charlie Project's narrative is a little more, how do I say it? Believable in that it's a little more concise and that they listed some links to newspapers. because of our school, wonderful school Wi-Fi, of course. They were blocked, however.
Oh, of course.
Oh, of course, yeah. And so I can't be sure, but the Charlie Project, I have a lot of knowledge about and faith in. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very good organization. Not to say that DonutWork.org isn't. It's just I'm more familiar with the Charlie Project, so I'm more inclined to, you know, believe them.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. So, all right. Here's why I think that Hilton might have been a victim of Jeffrey Lynn Hands. So, first of all, Hilton physically matched other victims, both theorized and confirmed. She was young, white, and petite, as she stood at 5'3 and weighed about 120 pounds. Hilton also worked as a nursing aide at St. Anthony's Hospital, while also studying as a nursing student in Lakeland College. One of Hand's confirmed victims, and two potential victims, were college students. Perhaps Hand had prowled around Lakeland College's campus, saw Hilton, and followed her until she was alone on that Friday night. Now, following the Charlie Project's narration of events, Hilton's car is a key component of her potential ties to Hand. If you remember, the car was found with flies buzzing around the trunk, which is certainly suspicious, because flies buzz around foul things such as feces, rotten food, and the like due to their smell. A recent rainstorm had washed all fingerprints off the exterior of the car. Perhaps blood evidence was washed off the car as well. The type of flies that were buzzing around Hilton's car were not identified, but some flies, such as deer flies and horse flies, feed on blood, and so depending on the breed of the flies, their presence might signify the presence of blood, and hence the suggestion of a violent crime around Hand's car, or Hilton's car. I had to do so much research on flies for that section,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, I mean, you know your stuff. Never did I think that you could use the type of fly to identify if there's blood or not. That's okay.
I know, yeah. But then also in relation to Hilton's car, two of Hand's other theorized victims and one of his confirmed victims had their cars found in parking lots or along the side of highways. And if you remember, Hilton's car was found abandoned along the highway as well in both narratives. So another thing is that Montrose, the location from which Hilton disappeared, is only 2 hours away from Warrenton, where Hand's home was located. Though Hand would travel throughout the Midwest, namely in Indiana and Illinois, Montrose is especially close to Warrenton. Though possibly a coincidence, Hilton was a single mother. Another one of Hand's possible victims was also a single mother. Furthermore, Hilton had dated interracially in the past, and Hand was described as someone who couldn't stand interracial marriage. Perhaps if Hand at some point learned this about Hilton, it might have led to him killing her.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. That's... I mean, okay. I know we, last time we discussed at the end, like, which we think are plausible and which aren't. Are we going to do that again?
Yeah, if you'd like.
Okay. Okay. So we'll save that for the end, but that's very interesting. There's a lot of coincidences, I guess.
Yeah, the fly detail is really odd to me. I know forensic science at the time wasn't very advanced or anything. It's just an odd detail. You know, it's just odd to me. You hear a lot of, like, you know, blood stains and, you know, the smell of stuff, but it's odd, I guess, that flies were found there. I don't know, that just kind of strikes me.
And
odd.
I know it's, like, kind of a small detail, but was the trunk, like, completely empty? Like, there was nothing else?
Yeah, they didn't find anything in the trunk.
So, like, it was just, there was no, like, items or anything? Or
pretty
just...
much. Huh. Like, it was just, like, her keys were missing, but, like, the car wasn't disabled, it wasn't, like, ransacked, it was like she just got out of the car.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, there are some points that make it unlikely that Hilton was a victim of Hand, much less a murder victim. First and foremost, if the narrative about Hilton going to the High Point Tavern is correct, then it basically debunks any chance of Hand having murdered Hilton, as Hilton was last seen leaving the tavern with two unknown men. There is a possibility that Hand might have been one of these guys, but serial killers working together to murder victims isn't unheard of. But Hand acted alone in his known murders, and something even less likely than a serial killer duo is a serial killer duo that parts ways to commit their own crimes. Something also worth noting is that the police personally believe that Hilton left on her own accord. Hilton was an unwed single mother, and she had been pregnant at least one more time and allegedly gave birth to a stillborn baby. Hilton had also dated interracially, which was still controversial at the time, especially in Sleepy Montrose, which had a population of about 300 in the 1970s. Hilton was also described as a poor student at her nursing school, which could have made her feel hopeless about her future. It's extremely likely that Hilton simply tired of her troubled life and decided to move elsewhere to start her life anew. Another point is that there's no concrete forensic evidence that Hilton was murdered. Flies buzzing around the trunk of her car doesn't mean she was killed, and there are no other implications of a crime even occurring toward Hilton. Yeah, so that, again, that the narrative difference is weird, like, because they're so polar opposite. Like, if it was just a few little, like, you know, time details, then that would be that, but it's just odd that there's such, like, split, like, such a fork. You know,
right.
And
looking at each of them, it really depends on, you know, the circumstances, the different circumstances, like the tavern, like whether you can come to, like the conclusion that, oh, I think that it was hand, or, oh, I think that it wasn't hand, you know, like, mm-hmm. But we don't know which one is closest to what happened, so that's... But good job, like, collecting those.
Yeah, well, we got 7 more pages, buddy. Hold tight.
Heck yeah.
Well, it's still unknown what happened to Barbara Ann Hilton. Hilton was mistakenly reported as being found in February of 2013, but unfortunately the report was not true. If alive, Hilton would be 73 years old. If you have information about Hilton's whereabouts, you are asked to call Effingham County Sheriff's Office at 217-342-2101. Alright. So our next possible victim is Vicki Lynn Harrell, a woman who was murdered on August 12, 1972, 8 days after Hilton's disappearance.
Oh.
So Vicki Lynn Harrell was an attractive, red-headed 26-year-old woman who worked at Kmart's menswear department to support her daughter, Samantha. Harrell was a divorcee, which at the time was still considered controversial, and she had to raise Samantha as a single mother. Harrell had graduated Shawswick High School in the class of 1965 and was also a member of the Bedford Pilgrim Holiness Church. On the day of her disappearance, on August 12th, Harrell had worked at Kmart all day and entered into her four-door, dark blue, 1965 Plymouth Valiant in the parking lot after her shift, and she was never seen again. When she didn't return to her home that night, her roommate became concerned since Harrell had never done this before, and began making phone calls to see where Harrell was. She could find no information, however, so the day after Harrell disappeared, Harrell's roommate called the police. On Sunday, 2 days after her disappearance, Harrell's Plymouth was found in the parking lot of a college mall near Bloomington, which was about 30 minutes away from Spencer, Indiana. Vicky's belongings, such as her purse, were not found in the vehicle. The next day, only one day before Harrell's 27th birthday, Harrell's body was found face down in a ditch of water near Concord Road in Spencer by a worker from the Owen County Highway Department. Her body, which was nude, was about 32 minutes away from her car, and none of her belongings were at the scene, including her clothes. Her belongings, in fact, would never be found. Police found that she had been strangled with a rope and had likely been sexually assaulted by her attacker. Due to there not being evidence of a struggle at the scene, it was speculated that Harrell was killed at a different location and her body was then dropped off in the area. Harrell's attacker had, for whatever reason, used a knife or blunt object to carve the letters K-N into Harrell's lower chest post-mortem.
K-N?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you think that could be, like, initials, or... That's a really interesting
detail. It's... I spent some time trying to think, like, what would K-N mean to Jeffrey Lynn Hand, but I couldn't really think of anything.
Yeah.
Because I went to initials of some sort. It's disturbing, but, like, marking, so what, of, like, a kill, you know? Like, how people hunt deer and then mount their head on the wall, you know what I mean? But.
Right.
I'm not too sure. So, we're gonna get into some reasons why I think Harrell might have been a victim of Hand. So, first of all, Harrell was described as being a young and pretty woman. Hand's victims, confirmed and theorized, were both of a similar age group. If Hand did indeed kill Harrell, then Harrell would have actually been the oldest person he attacked, as the second oldest victim of his was 25 years old. And it's also worth noting that, like Hilton, Harrell was a single mother and had been divorced. If coincidence, then this is just void. But, perhaps Hand held some sort of prejudice against single mothers. None of Hand's other victims, theorized or confirmed, were parents, however. Like two of Hand's theorized victims and one of Hand's confirmed victims, Harrell's car was found abandoned. including Harrell, one of the four people Hand had possibly attacked, two of their cars were found abandoned along highways, and the other half's cars were found in parking lots. Also, two of Hand's other theorized victims had their bodies dumped along the road. What is also similar is the details about her attack. Harrell had been sexually assaulted like other victims of Hand, and she had also been strangled to death with a rope. Another of Hand's victims had been strangled with a clothesline, and a potential victim had been strangled with a shoelace.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Okay.
You and I talked about this, which is morbid, but Peyton and I talked about how, a few days ago, how, like being hung or being strangled to death has got to be one of the worst ways to go. Like, you know, it's something basic. It's not, like, I guess the worst way to die, but, like, personally, I won't speak for you, Peyton, but personally, just, like, the times that, like, I as a kid have, like, struggled to find air or whatever, it's just such, like, a feeling of, like, overwhelming fear. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, in my opinion, that's got to be one of the worst ways to go.
Right, and that's, I'm not Jeffrey Lynn Hand, so I'm not going to speak for him, but, you know, a lot of serial killers and murderers, they have just, like, the motivation to see their victims suffering, and I think definitely, you know, hangings and, you know, anything to do with strangulation that prolongs the death, and, gosh, I really am getting morbid, but, you know, it's really unfortunate that that's what happened to them. But
yeah, and of course, there are some reasons that Harrell might have not been a victim of Hand. So you might note that Barbara Ann Hilton's disappearance date and the day that Harrell was last seen are only 8 days apart. Serial killers that kill in such short time spans exist, such as Richard Ramirez, who sometimes attack different families on the same night. However, they are rare, though the timeline and the location of Harrell's murder in relation to Hilton's disappearance isn't impossible, it is unlikely. Perhaps Hilton's murder didn't go the way Hand wanted to, and so he murdered Harrell to get his fill, so to say. And another odd thing about her murder is, like I mentioned before, that the letters KN were carved into her chest. It's hard to think of why Hand might have carved these specific letters into her chest. Furthermore, none of Hand's other victims had any sort of injury relating to, you know, knives or, like, anything carved into them. And so finally, Harrell's body was the only one found naked. Perhaps that signifies that Hand was somehow interrupted in his attack on Harrell, but considering that he had enough time to kill her and then carve two letters into her chest, her being left nude doesn't really make a lot of sense, in my opinion. And also, I need to correct myself. One of Hand's confirmed victims was stabbed to death, but there was no sort of post-mortem, like, carving or anything like that, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that you and I, we need to go get degrees in criminology.
I thought you were about to say we should go kill someone, and I was like, not on the podcast, please.
We'll talk about that later.
Oh, yeah.
But we need to go get our degrees, and we need to figure this out, because I'm invested now. What is KN?
You know, and the thing is, too, is as I looked into, like, potential victims, part of me was wondering, like, is this an actual rational theory, or is this just me wanting to be, like, you know, solving the case, if that makes sense? Like, it would suck that they were all murdered by this, you know, jerk, but, you know, we all want these things to be solved. So, you know what I mean? It was hard sometimes, like, separating what I wanted to be solved from, like, what could actually be solved.
Exactly, and that's the thing, we don't know, and we may never know.
Yeah. And yeah, the thing with Hilton is, like, she disappeared, so at least, like, in my head, I can be like, you know what, maybe she just moved to the Bahamas and is living her best life, but, you know, unfortunately with, murder victims like Harrell, you don't really get that, you know, comfort.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Harrell's murderer was never found, and she was buried at Hilltop Cemetery, and now both of her parents have passed away without learning about what happened to their daughter. If alive today, Vicki Lynn Harrell would be 76 years old. If you have any information about Vicki Lynn Harrell's murder, you are asked to call the Indiana State Police at 1-812-332-441 or at 1-800-423-1286. All right. So now we're going to get into our first confirmed murder, which is that of 19-year-old college student Pamela Gail Malam on the night of September 15th, 1972. Pamela Malam was a 19-year-old student at Indiana State University in Terre Haute, Indiana, who was described as a bubbly, agreeable young woman who would, quote-unquote, help you out without you asking. She was described as having boyish features, sandy blonde hair, greenish eyes, and freckled skin. She was beloved by her family and by her co-workers at the local public library, in which she had worked ever since her senior year of high school. Her employer described her as very quiet, but very, very capable, and beautiful inside and out. Her older sister, Charlene, and her younger sister, Sheila, especially adored her. Sheila and Pam were practically twins, with Sheila stating to IndyStar that, quote-unquote, she was the most important person in her life. Charlene described Malam as the kind of person you want to have in the room with you. After graduating Honey Creek High School in 1971 as a member of the National Honor Society, Malam decided to enroll at ISU with the intention of becoming an English teacher. She was a member of the Sigma Kappa sorority, and Sheila, a freshman at ISU, was planning on joining as well. Malam, unfortunately, would never see her sister join. On the night of September 15, 1972, Malam had been staying at the Sigma Kappa suite at ISU's Lincoln Quad during the sorority's recruitment festivities. After a party on the 15th, Malam told some of her sorority sisters that she would return back to the suite in a few minutes to move her car closer to the dorm, and then she left the building. She entered into her red 1964 Pontiac Le Mans around 11 p.m., and she would never be seen alive again. The next day, Malam didn't show up for work, which was extremely uncharacteristic of her. Immediately, her father and Sheila spent the day searching for her on campus but were unsuccessful. Around 7 p.m. that day, two of her sorority sisters spotted her 1964 Pontiac Le Mans parked about a block away from where it had been parked the day before. Upon closer inspection, the sisters noticed that Malam's father noticed that Malam's glasses were sitting on the rear window shelf. A little over an hour and a half later, Malam's father and Sheila went to Malam's car with a spare set of keys. Her car was missing a right rear hubcap and was also missing an attached Jesus sign on her front license plate holder. Inside the car, they found that her car keys were missing and that her purse was completely empty. The two finally went to the trunk, and Malam's father screamed when he saw that his daughter's dead body was inside.
Oh my gosh.
A thin white clothesline was tied around her neck, and her wrists had been bound in the same material. A notably excessive amount of white masking tape over her mouth held a gag in place. Malam had a number of scratches and bruises on her body, which indicated a struggle. However, wounds to Malam's face and head were attributed to the sharp taillight assemblies within the trunk. The coroner would also determine that her cause of death was strangulation. She was found fully clothed, but later investigation would later find a stick and other debris in her pantyhose and pants, which indicates that her pants had been removed at some point, likely in a wooded area. On her light blue blouse was a semen stain containing DNA evidence that would later become key for identifying Hand as her killer. A roll of tape and the clothesline that Malam had been strangled with were among items Malam had used to decorate for the party she was attending on the night of her death. Police investigation began, but the agency didn't have much to work with at the time. There are no witnesses, nor any descriptions for a potential suspect. At the time, police believed a man named Robert Wayne Austin may have been responsible for her death. Austin had been arrested after a series of abductions and abduction attempts at ISU 7 weeks after Malam was found dead. Austin would abduct female students, sexually assault them, and then return to ISU's campus. Though he would be convicted of rape, sodomy, and kidnapping, and would be sentenced to life in prison, he denied having any connection to Malam's death, and no concrete evidence against him was found. After Austin served 2 decades of his sentence and was released on parole, he was officially removed as a suspect from the case in 2008, when DNA evidence eliminated his potential involvement. Malam's case was solved when Terre Haute Police Chief Sean Keene began working with Parabon Nanolabs in 2018. Parabon, a Virginia-based company that works with law enforcement, had helped to identify the Golden State Killer in California and the murderer of April Marie Tinsley here in Fort Wayne, so this partnership brought a lot of hope that the case would finally be solved. using the semen stain found on Malam's blouse and touch DNA from the rope that had been used to strangle Malam, Parabon ran the DNA through a public genetic genealogy base. Using this field of study, which is called genetic genealogy, they found that the DNA found on Malam had a 99.49 chance of being belonging to Hand. Though Malam's case was officially solved in 2019, Malam's loss hasn't gotten any easier for her sisters. In an interview with IndyStar, Sheila said, "Since we found out, I mean, it just feels like a whole new world to me. I carried the weight for so long. I feel as though I'm now allowed to more freely live and enjoy and act and commit and even love fully." Though thankfully Malam's sisters have lived to see her killer identified, both of Malam's parents died before Hand was identified as her killer. Malam was buried at Mount Pleasant Cemetery in Terre Haute, Indiana, and if she was alive today, she would be 68 years old. And I wanted to say really quick, I wanted to give a shout-out to the Sean Keen, the Terre Haute police chief. He, like, I didn't include this, you know, here in my script, but he did a lot of work to solve this case. Like, he went above and beyond. And I don't want to get political, but in a day and age where a lot of police officers are accused of corruption and just neglect of their duties, it was really nice to see an officer do his job and do it really well.
Exactly.
Parabon Labs, of course, had a key role in, of course, identifying Hand as the murderer, but I don't think this case could have been solved without Keen, so I just wanted to give him props where it's due, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, that's the, yeah, I know, right? That's the thing. There's so many, like, murder cases where they could have been solved either immediately or, like, you know, a little after if, like, the people in charge did their job. You read a lot of, like, cases where they find, like, you know, blood from the killer in the house, and they just go, "Ew, throw it away," you know? And it's right. Just, like...
And then we look back on it, like, 20 years later, and it's like, well, okay. And like this case, I mean, I know, you know, Keen did his part, but it was solved pretty late. I mean, both her parents were dead, and that's really unfortunate that they didn't get to see, like, the answer to what had actually happened. But yeah, it's just really, and also, I know I'm kind of changing subjects, so I'm sorry about that, but I think you did a really good job, and I know we've talked about this before, outside of the podcast, how it's really important to include details when talking about things like this about, you know, the actual people and what they were like, and you included a lot of quotes about, like, her sister Sheila, and that's really important.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's the thing, like, it made me... writing this whole script has made me sad, but, specifically, the thing that really got to me was when I was writing the script, there were some, people where there just wasn't details about who they were, and of course, it's horrible to die in a horrible fashion, but it's also just very sad to me that, like, in a way, who they were as a person is kind of erased, and they just become a corpse, so to say.
Exactly, another statistic.
I know. So, how do I say it? I know some of the details in this are just like, she went to this church, but I think it's very important to, you know, because sometimes I forget myself, and I think it's important to remind ourselves that these were people. These weren't just, you know, numbers, or these just weren't, like, an unsolved case. These were people.
Exactly, and they were more than what happened to them.
Yeah. Alright, and now we're going to move on to two more confirmed victims of Hand's, Jeffrey Wayne Buffalo Thomas and Carol A. Thomas. Though unfortunately Jeffrey would not survive the encounter with Hand, Carol would. So at least there's a bit of a silver lining.
Exactly.
So on June 16th, 1973, 22-year-old Jeffrey Wayne Buffalo Thomas and his 19-year-old wife Carol A. Thomas were attempting to hitch a ride along Highway US 41 back to their home in Evansville. Having returned from visiting Jeffrey's parents in Chicago, it was 9 p.m., it was hot out, and nobody had pulled over for them yet. The two had been married for only 17 days, and it's worth noting that Jeffrey was black and Carol was white. Later, when Hand was put on trial for the attack on the two, witnesses would state that Hand was someone who couldn't stand interracial marriage. But just when the two thought their luck had run out, a turquoise Chevrolet pulled over to the side of the road and stopped. The driver, who was unfortunately Jeffrey Lynn Hand, told the two that he was heading south to his home in Warrenton, and they could ride along if they wanted. The couple agreed, as they too were heading south, and they climbed into the car. They all drove in silence for 2 hours when the car reached Warrenton. And then Hand, he told the couple that he wanted to stop at his sister's house to, quote-unquote, see about getting some money. They kept driving and finally arrived at a shabby, run-down-looking farm on Warrenton Road. Hand then got out of the car and rummaged under the front seat. Suddenly, he pulled out a .38 caliber revolver and aimed it at them, telling them that this was a holdup. He said to them, Now, the way I want us to do this is to be real quiet. I don't want anybody to make a noise. Jeffrey and Carol thought that Hand was joking at first, but then Hand fired a shot into the roof of the car. "Just so we understand each other," he said. He told them that he was robbing them, and he needed money to keep traveling. But there was a problem. The couple only had $1.17, which is a little over $7 in today's money. This made Hand angry, and he forced the two into a nearby grain silo, tied them up with rope, and then left them there while he went into his house to think of a new plan. While he was gone, the two almost managed to get free of their restraints and were about to run. However, right before they could do so, Hand returned with his gun and a fresh set of wire. Hand told them that he was going to keep Carol hostage in the grain silo while he and Jeffrey drove to Evansville to get a $400 ransom from Jeffrey's brother. Hand told them that once he received the money, he'd let both of them go. Hand then forced Jeffrey to tie up Carol's hands with a nylon cord. And at around 2 a.m., the two men got into a different car that Hand owned, a 1964 Pontiac, and drove off into the night. It would be the last time that Carol would see her husband alive. While Hand and Jeffrey were away, Carol managed to free herself and ran towards a nearby farmhouse. She called the state authorities. Troopers picked her up, and finally, she was safe. Hand, presumably unaware of Carol's escape and the police presence at his house, was arrested immediately after he tried to return to his farmhouse. He was taken to Gibson County Jail in Princeton, Indiana. Hand finally revealed what happened to Jeffrey after rigorous interrogation from police and a talk with his father. He had killed Jeffrey and had dumped his body along State Road 62. He said he would lead him to his body. Jeffrey's body was found in a weedy area a little over the Posey County line. Thomas had been shot in the face with a .22 caliber rifle. His hands were tied behind his back. His throat had been slashed, and Hand had stabbed him 8 times in the chest and abdomen. Hand was charged with first-degree murder immediately after Jeffrey's body was found. He would be charged with kidnapping for ransom a few days later, and his bond was set at $100,000. Jeffrey Wayne Buffalo Thomas was buried at Oakville Cemetery in Evansville, Indiana. If he were alive today, he would be 71 years old.
Okay, well, I'm glad that at this point, you know, Hand got arrested and was caught, but it's extremely unfortunate that that had to happen to Jeffrey Wayne Thomas to be able to get that justice.
Yeah, I wanted to say for both the Thomases, like, I think it's really, really, how do I say it, honorable that, you know... it's very unfortunate that Hand returned, like, right as they were about to get out. It's just, in a different timeline, you know, right? It's like, maybe if Hand had tripped on the stairs and took a second longer or whatever, they'd be free. But just, I think, big shout out to Carol and Jeffrey, at least, for not going out with, you know, in silence. They fought, and mm-hmm. I really respect that.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's odd, if you note, it's odd that, Jeffrey had been, like, you know, killed so brutally, right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot, it wasn't, like, a clean, you know, I gotta get you out of the way kill or anything. It was, like, it was violent, which would seem to, how do I say, suggest that there was some sort of hatred there. Mm-hmm. So,
Do you think that, you mentioned how Hand had said that they were going to go get money from, Jeffrey's brother? Do you think that was a lie, or was he... Because I don't know how he would have gotten in contact with,
his brother. Yeah.
So did he just say that to get him in the car and get him away from Carol?
I mean, maybe. I never thought about that before. That's a good question. Because the thing is, it's like, so right, he originally tried to rob them, but, you know, he took them, so either he's really stupid, or just like, you know, was intending to kill them, because he took them to their house, he, you know, was with them for a long time, like, they got to see his face and everything, they got to see his car, you know, it but the thing is, right, is that he held them up first. If he was just going to kill them and take their money, wouldn't he have just arrived at the house, right, killed them, and then searched through their pockets?
Right, that's interesting.
Yeah, so what I've read about Hand, it doesn't seem like he was exactly the brightest crayon in the drawer. So, I mean, it's very possible he just, like, did not think this through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing, right? When you're investigating cases, sometimes people will be like, well, this and this don't make sense. Like, you know, that's illogical. Why would they do this? Or why would they say this? And it's like, well, people are illogical. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, horrible enough to be killing someone, or if you're under enough stress to where someone's trying to kill you or whatever, you're not always going to be thinking rationally.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't really know what Jeffrey's, or what Han's motives were, but they definitely did not end well for the two. So, following Jeffrey Thomas's brutal death and Carol Thomas's kidnapping, Jeffrey Lynn Hand was imprisoned and therefore unable to hurt anybody for the time being. And in our next episode on Hand, we'll be talking about Hand's trial and his time under state custody. We'll also see what events led up to Hand being released from prison 3 years after the murder of Jeffrey Wayne Thomas and the abduction of Carol Thomas. Finally, we'll be looking into some cases of missing and murdered women that I believe may have been unfortunately been victims of Hand. Yeah, I don't... Like,
he was released?
3 years.
What? How does that even happen?
And I don't want to spoil anything, of course, but he got out on a technicality, basically. And also,
really?
That with Pamela Milam, the Robert Wayne Austin fellow, he only served 20 years, and then he got out on parole for all those...
Oh my god!
So it's like... Listen, I believe in the process of law and the process of the justice system, but, you know... It reminds me of, you know, the Casey Anthony case?
I don't. I'm
you
sorry.
You don't? Oh, wow. Okay. Sorry.
Enlighten me.
It was basically this, well, I'm not allowed to say profane words on this podcast, but this horrible human being of a mother basically killed her toddler.
Oh, gosh.
But she got away with it because they couldn't prove beyond reasonable doubt forensically that she had murdered her daughter. But they found even more evidence now that correlates to Casey Anthony killing her toddler daughter. But because of double jeopardy laws, she can't be tried again.
Wow.
So,
okay, that's...
So I'm not, you know, gonna sit here and pretend like I have answers to these things, but there's cases like that where it's like, that's a miscarriage of justice. That isn't just, like, an unfortunate side effect of having, you know, a working justice system. Like, that is a flaw, and needs to be fixed.
And, like, 2 minutes ago, I was like, oh, well, that's sad that that happened to Jeffrey Thomas, but at least there was justice. And then, oh, he got out 3 years later? Like, okay, never mind.
I know. And that's the thing. Like, I don't want to, how do I say, get dramatic about it, but... When these criminals get released and they go on to commit more crimes, I mean, arguably, the authorities that let them out have just as much blood on their hands as Han does.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean...
Hands as hands.
Yeah, there's probably a pun there, but I'm not...
Right, this is not the time.
I'm not smart enough to, like, come up with a
you
pun
are. You're,
it.
You're very good at puns.
Ignore my math grade. But, alright, so what do you think? Like... I've only, like, the viewers at home can't see this, but these are all the victims I've compiled, potentially to be victims of Hand. Barbara Ann Hilton, Vicki Lynn Harrell, Pamela Milam, Jeffrey Wayne Thomas, and then next episode we'll be talking about Deborah Jane Bennett, Margaret Ann Hayes, and Anne Louise Harmeyer. But of the, well, we know Pam, and we know, Thomas were unfortunately victims of Hand. What do you think about Harrell and Hilton?
I mean, okay. Last podcast, I was like, oh my gosh, it definitely was that person. Like, mm-hmm. And I don't want to jump to conclusions because, like you said, I think it's just my, like, brain wanting to make connections and say, like, oh yeah, that's what happened, and, like, just have it make sense.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, there's really no way we can know, and that's the...
Really quick, for the viewers at home, I'm stealing some of Peyton's Dr. Pepper.
It's really flat, so...
But I like flat soda, okay. So it all works out. But go on, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
I just did, like, a shot of it.
Yeah, that was great. Okay. I mean, what do you think? Do you think that...
I think Harrell was very likely a victim of Hand, just because the modus operandi, apart from, again, the two letters carved into her,
mm-hmm.
I think lines up with how Hand would conduct his murders. Hilton, I'm not so sure, because, one, there's those two different narratives, so my entire theory is, you know, dead in the water if the one about her leaving the tavern is true. Exactly. And also, she went missing, and unfortunately missing people are sometimes missing because they're murder victims and they haven't been found, but I think there's more room for interpretation there with her case.
And it seems like, I think it was one of the sources that you mentioned said that her body could have been put into a well that was filled, but it doesn't seem like based on Harrell, which obviously not confirmed, but like Malam and the Thomases, like, well, Jeffrey Wayne Thomas, mm-hmm. not Carol, but he didn't really care much about hiding it. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of just put their bodies out there.
Yeah. If Hilton was his first murder, then it maybe it would make sense that he would hide the body, because, you know, you're just starting out, you're like a little nervous.
You would know.
I would know, of course, yeah. You know, just everyday things. And then with Harrell, it's like, she's by the side of the road, and it's a county road, so it's not, like, super out there, but it is a little bit maybe, like, showboating to leave her naked and not really covered up or anything. But then with Malam, I think that's, like, the ultimate middle finger, just, like, putting her body in the trunk, which maybe was like an impromptu, I don't have a lot of time to, you know, hide her mm-hmm. body, I gotta run. But I think that's like the ultimate, you know, I killed this woman, I'm leaving her body out, you can't find me.
In her own car. And that's, it's, it makes me so sad that her father and her sister were the ones to find her. That's...
Mm-hmm. So... Something I've wondered, though, is how we know how they would, they died, right? If they, and if it's connected to Hand, though, I wonder how he got to that point, if that makes sense. That sounds like a stupid question, but I mean, like, you know, it's not like you can just say, you know, well, I guess what I'm saying is, how does this happen? Like, does he offer them, like, a ride? Does he, you know...
Right, like, how does he, sorry, I didn't mean
no,
to
go ahead.
You, but, like, how does he know, he doesn't know these people, you know what, I'm sorry, it's too early for this, but, like, does he just try and find random people who fit his, like,
description,
like, does he talk to them, does he interact with them, it's just really...
Mm-hmm. So, like, what I was maybe thinking myself is... with murders like Malam, it's a little odd because, like, you know, she wasn't in any position to be hitchhiking or to give rides to a hitchhiker. So her death, I think I might have even read in one of the sources, though I could be I could be mistaken on this, is that police think that her death might have been impromptu, like she was by her car and Hand just came up and killed her. But for murders like Hilton and Harrell, with Hilton, I wonder if that was a he was offering her a ride situation, and if with Harrell it was, you know, he was pretending to be a hitchhiker.
Yeah.
But it's weird because serial killers, I mean, they're usually not that versatile in how they get into a position where they can kill someone, if that makes sense. It's usually like they find their shtick and they stick to it. So I'm gonna have another shot of Dr. Pepper.
Go ahead.
Yeah. But what do you think? Oh, that's a lot of Dr. Pepper.
Gotta stay fueled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I agree. I mean, like, none of that stuff I had thought about, and you made some really good points. You always do.
Well, thank you.
But yeah, I don't know. Hilton, it's the two different
narratives,
and it's like we don't even know what she was doing that night. Like, both of them said that she was with different people. Like, it's yeah.
Well, I think unless we have any comments we'd like to make, that marks the end of our podcast. We'll see you guys next time, and thank you guys so much for tuning in.